Episode 24. Here we go. You know, I was catching up with an old friend of mine recently, and she said, isn't it funny how much amazing music came out when we were in high school? And I agreed with her. I thought she was spot on. I mean, some of the best music ever came out when I was in high school, which is funny. But I mean, of course, you always end up loving the bands that you were listening to during that time. And this next act is that for me. I remember being in high school, taking guitar lessons from my local music teacher and telling him that there were no modern bands that rocked hard and had big guitars. And he said, oh, sure there are. You gotta check out this band, Blackberry Smoke. And I did. And I mean, I guess the rest is history. I fell in love. To this day, one of my favorite bands, especially one of my favorite rock guitar oriented bands. I'm obsessed. I listen to every record that they put out. I know every song, every word. They're that band for me. Like, I think everyone has that band or a couple of those bands. Blackberry Smoke is that band to me that hit me at the right time, and I just love them. But I mean, in all seriousness, they are an amazing rock band. So much energy, so much fun to watch live. The songs are amazing. The harmonies, the vocal harmonies are amazing. They're just a great band. They've been carving it out for years, and this was an amazing opportunity. I was so excited to interview Charlie. And by the way, this band never takes a break. Even in quarantine, they're on the road performing these drive-in shows. They're doing a live stream tomorrow night at the Ryman. Tickets are still on sale tomorrow, September 23rd, depending on when you're listening to this. I'll be watching for sure. Tickets are still on sale. You can go to their website and check them out. Okay, I'm done because I can't wait for you guys to listen to this. Let's dive in. So, how do you get George Jones to sing on Little Piece of Dixie? He's on Yesterday's Wine at the end of the record. How do you guys get him on that recording?
Well, initially I reached out to Jamie Johnson to come and be a duet partner. Really. He said yes at that point, you know, and then Trey Wilson, our manager, was working with George. And I believe it was Trey that said, why don't we ask George? And I thought, well, why don't we? While we're at it, let's ask, you know, Merle Haggard and Willie Nelson. If we're asking, let's just, you know, meaning that I didn't think in a million years that he would say yes. And sure enough, he said, I'll be there. Let me know what time. And I didn't really think it was going to happen until he walked through the door. And then it was, because I mean, I had never spoken with him, you know. And he walked in and it was like, oh, okay, this is real. This is really going to happen.
Holy cow. And because there's a great video where you guys are all in the studio together singing. Like, what was that experience like? Like, was it totally surreal, or what? Do you remember much of it?
I do remember. It was very surreal. The producer that worked the session, James Stroud, he had worked with George before, and he said, "I don't know what George will want to do. I don't know if he'll want to sing the whole song, or if he'll want to, you know, just sing a couple of lines, or whatever, you know." Might have been. And right at that point that week, George turned 80. So, you know, James was like, I don't know how much he wants to work, you know, he's kind of past that. And but George came in and we played him the audio. Well, actually, we had already recorded the audio, and Jamie and I had both put a vocal down. So George came in and he was like, why don't we sing the whole thing again? And we said, yes, that'll be great. Let's sing the whole thing again. So that's what we did. Somewhere on a hard drive, I've got the whole day video. And it's fantastic. There's a lot of stuff that's not safe for work that was said between takes on all of our parts. Even he had us in stitches, he being George Jones. He was better than advertised.
Absolutely. So I started listening to you guys, Little Piece of Dixie, when that record came out. And I remember I was in high school, and the other day, like yesterday, I was going through the liner notes, and I totally didn't realize that Dan Huff was involved in that record. And he was the what was he executive producer of production, or he had like a title in the liner notes. How did Dan Huff get involved with you guys? And like how did you first connect with him?
Well, he was co-producer of that record. He and Justin Ebank. Yeah, he produced it alongside Justin Ebank. How we met Dan was through a mutual friend in Nashville named Bruce Birch. And I'm not sure if Dan had heard any of our music before that meeting. Maybe he had, but he came to meet us in Atlanta at a show that we played at this little bar. And it's a funny thing. He was very nice. He came in and we were in a van touring around the country, you know, playing every honky tonk between here and California. And we came in on no sleep. And so I think all of us were kind of like, yeah, whatever. You know, I mean, like I haven't slept in 3 days. But then we sound checked and Britt, our drummer, turned his ankle stepping down off the little stage. And like, it was kind of a go to the hospital kind of moment. Like he basically broke his ankle. It was like, oh, great. You know, we're going to play for this guy who wants to basically sign us to a deal. And the drummer's broken ankle. So he went and got one of those like air cast things put on and played the show. And as far as I can remember, it was really good. But Dan came, you know, after and was like, I love it. Let's make a record. In the beginning, it was, I don't know if the plan was to make a full album or just to make some, like an EP or record some singles. I don't know. That was a very confusing period for our band because we were kind of hopping label situations. And but that's basically, then we went in and made, it was very piecemeal. We would go in and record a couple of songs and then Dan was really busy. And then he'd be like, okay, let's get together again in 3 weeks. And we were like, oh, okay. And I mean, he was in demand, you know, he's working with Keith Urban and Rascal Flatts and all these bands. And I mean, who were we, you know, to demand we make it now, the whole album. But anyway, so by the time we were done, we had recorded 12 or 13 songs, you know, and put them all together and was like, okay, here's our record. And it was fun. We recorded at some great studios, Blackbird and The Castle. And then we did some work at Justin's house out in Leaper's Fork at the time, which was beautiful. And it was really cool.
How was it fun to work on guitar sounds with Dan? Was he very hands-on with that? Did he kind of let you run with your own tone? What was it like sort of, you know, recording guitars and doing guitars with him?
Well, he kind of let us go. I think he wanted to capture the sound that we were getting, you know. And I did ask him at one point, we were sitting around doing some, I think putting a solo down, and I said, Dan, do you want to play on this at all? And I think he said something like, you don't want me to take this away from you, buddy.
I love it. So, okay, wait. So these drive-in shows that just got announced, how do those come together? Does Live Nation reach out to you guys? Do you go after them and say, hey, we're dying to play. What can we do? How did those ideas first come onto the table?
Well, I don't really know specifically. I think it usually is a call made to our agent, you know, and then obviously there are feelers out there and because we want to work, you know, badly, just like everybody. And it's been great to know that you can do this, you know, because there obviously for months and months, it's been live stream or nothing, you know, and I saw some bands going and doing those early drive-in shows with no PA. And it was, you know, the people sit in their car and listen to basically their car stereo, which I was like,
right.
Wow, is that something we want to leave the house to go do? You know, I mean, business obviously is different, you know, the business model. So, but it was really cool when it finally came to fruition that there were going to be shows that were actual shows. You're just, the audience is placed differently, you know, and distancing and the cars and the little delineated rectangles. And But we did, you know, we just did some in last week. We did a couple in Pennsylvania and Massachusetts and New Jersey and Virginia, and it was fantastic.
So there was a post on Instagram a little while before where it looked like you guys were in like a rehearsal space, and you were like, we're dusting off, you know, the cobwebs or whatever. After not playing for a while and you guys come together to rehearse, how much rehearsal do you guys need to get back up to where you're at? Is it like riding a bike, or, you know, do you feel a little rusty?
Definitely rusty. We only had time for one day with the whole band. And so I think after, you know, at this point, after 20 years, it's like, do your homework. Don't come in here unprepared. You're going to get the evil eye from everybody, you know. But it is a lot like the riding the bicycle. Muscle memory takes over, you know. It's like I was talking to a friend that sings and plays guitar about this the other day, and it's like funny how even certain motions, the way that you move your body when you play, you know, a certain riff and you sing a lyric, and it's like, my body has done this thousands upon thousands of times. So once you do it, it's like, that's what it is. I stood on the steps walking on stage at Madison Square Garden when we opened for Zac Brown back in 2010 or so. And it was sold out, and it was this tangible energy, you know. And we were terrified, of course, in the best way, butterflies. And I was standing on the steps and was like, oh no, what's the first line of the first verse of this song? And I started freaking out. And Paul Jackson was standing beside me, and I said, Paul, what are the first words of this song? And he's like, I don't know. You wrote it, you know? And I'm like, yeah, I don't know. But as soon as I stepped and played, you know, it's like, oh, that's
it. Can't be you.
So that night it was like, don't ever do that again. Don't ever stand there and try to remember what the lyrics are. They'll happen, you know?
They'll come to you. How do you guys figure out? I'm always curious because, you know, in like Sleeping, there's a couple songs like Sleeping Dogs or Ain't Much Left of Me where you always do these big jams in the middle. How do you work those up in rehearsals? Like, do you come up with them minutes before you go on stage? How do you put those together?
Well, we've never rehearsed any of them, and it really happens in the moment. And I'm sure the rest of the members of Blackberry Smoke hate me for this, but we don't talk about it. It's kind of like the elephant in the room, not in a bad way, but it's whatever happens spontaneously. And you know, many times Britt has come to me after and gone, what was that? What was that? You know? So, but that's part of something that's a thing that keeps it fresh and interesting to me. You know, it's almost like a game. Like, who's going to follow me when we start playing this Yes song?
Follow Charlie. That's the,
But absolutely. We did, after a while, you know, over the years, we've put different little snippets of songs in there. And there have been times where now we've done a bunch of them and been like, well, which one should we do? You know, you can't do, you know, you might go a tour doing one and then you come back and go, well, we got to do something different now. We can't do, you know, Led Zeppelin anymore. We got to do Herbie Hancock or something. So.
Right. You got to keep it interesting. Okay. So you're in the rehearsal room for these shows. And then do you guys take the bus to the venue or to the drive-in? How are you guys, do you guys travel? Yeah. For these drive-in shows, everyone's still getting in the bus and going down to them?
We did. We all had to be tested for COVID before we could get together, you know. And so we all went and did that. And then actually we had to be tested again. And I was told that it was because of the regulations in the state of Massachusetts. So we all went to Scranton. We were in Scranton, Pennsylvania the other day and all got up and got tested again, and we're all clean again, and you know, it's the new model.
What's it like with the energy of the crowd? Can you feel that the crowd is there? If they're singing along, can you hear that? Is it like, what, like how's the energy different?
It's a little different because they're pretty far away from the stage to start with,
right.
So it's a little hard to hear. But I think, I mean, I can, you can see it. Even people out there with masks on, you can see that they're happy because they're doing their thing and they're happy to be there. It's just it's a good energy. It's a different kind of energy than being all crammed up, you know, onto the stage. And it's just different, but it wasn't at all a disappointment to me. You know, I don't think to any of us, it was like, we're so happy to be up here together playing songs that it doesn't matter. It's good.
Are people honking their horns and like?
Yeah, there was a couple of honks, and I think that maybe that I don't know for sure, but I think maybe that had been discouraged. But we got some instead of like the stomping and clapping and chanting for an encore, it was
right. Unbelievable. Okay, wait. So in normal times, how many dates are you guys doing a year? Over 250? Close.
No. There were a handful of years where we did over 200, between 200 and 250, and that would kill the average bear. So we stay between 100 and 150 now. That's healthy. That's still a lot, you know, because that doesn't include travel days. Those are the shows.
Absolutely. So, okay. So now you're home probably for the first longest stretch of time since you've started this band. Are you going insane? How are you spending your time? Do you play guitar every day?
Yeah. Yeah. Always. I mean, they're always here. So, but I wrote a lot of songs. We made a new album with Dave Cobb just a couple of months ago.
Wow. And,
it's great, man. It's a guitar record.
He's the guy to do it with.
He's the guy. Yeah. We've known Dave a long time. He's an old Atlanta guy. You know, he was in a band here for years. But obviously he's uber successful and he's doing a great service to the world, making great sounding records. But we had, I had talked to him the last few years about, hey, let's make a record, you know, and finally, reached out when all this began, actually before it began, back in February. And he was like, yeah, let's go in the end of March. We were going to finish a Canadian tour and go straight into the studio. And of course that couldn't happen. So then, beginning of the summer, he was like, I got some time. If you guys feel comfortable, you know, we'll stay distanced and we'll wear our stuff and, you know, do our thing. So we did. And, I can't wait for the world to hear it, man. It's great.
Unbelievable.
But then we finished that and it's like, huh, all right, well, here I am back at home still. So just still writing songs. And I mean, there's, what else can you do? You know, that's.
Now, when you're recording with Dave, do you bring in all your guitars? He's got an amazing guitar collection. Are you playing some of his, like, are you guys going back and forth? Well, I'm sure. Does he pressure you to buy vintage gear? I've heard he does that also.
Well, I've got a lot. We do, especially Benji Shanks and I got a lot of vintage gear. So we spent a lot of time because we took a lot of it. And he would never say, no, don't bring that. You know, he's like, hell yeah, bring it all. So we spent a lot of time, you know, nerding out over this guitar and that amp and this fuzz pedal and that Echoplex. And I will say that according to Dave Cobb, I own the greatest EP3 that was ever built. That's it.
Wow.
A mid-70s Echoplex. So I got that going for me. He tried to buy it.
That's real cred.
Yeah. I might have sold it to him had he just said, hey man, want to sell this thing? But he prefaced it with, this is the greatest Echoplex I've ever heard. Want to sell it? And I said, of course not. Of course not. You just told me yourself. Why would I?
I can't sell it now. No way. Yeah. Or at least I'm going to up the price. It's like...
Right. Yeah, $500,000 sold.
Right. Yeah, yeah. When you sit down to practice, are you the kind of player that, do you have like a real routine? Do you play along to a record? Do you pick up the guitar and just try to make something that sounds good to you? Is there stuff you're still trying to work on? What kind of things do you practice?
I guess it varies. I mean, I think most guitar players, when you pick up a guitar, your hands are kind of like dogs. They go to a similar place a lot of the time. And that becomes part of the challenge of trying to be a better guitar player. You know, you try to say, okay, well, don't do that same thing over and over. You got to, you know, expand your musical vocabulary if you can. But I've always been really fascinated with jazz guitar. Well, jazz just in itself is such an advanced musical idea, you know, playing around the note and creating tension, and how far can you get it before it's just absolutely, you know, not even recognizable. There's a funny Spinal Tap video of those guys going, jazz is basically playing the music wrong.
Right, of course.
And why are you playing so quietly? What are you afraid of? Why is it so quiet?
Right. Well, it's funny because last week I just brought a Tele to get refretted, and I've had for probably 15 years, and it was the first time I've ever had fretwork done to it, and all the fretware was in the first 3 frets, the majority of it. He's like, that's where everyone plays. That's where.
Cowboy chord.
That's what it is. Well, I mean, I was thinking recently about how, you know, like, I'm sort of at the point now where I'm kind of around the age or starting to get older, where some of the records I listened to when I was younger, like the first Aerosmith record, Joe Perry was younger than I am now when I idolized that record. Yet to me, it still feels immortal. Like it feels like, you know, that's such incredible guitar playing. But it's weird to think about that he was younger than me when he played that. As you've gotten older as a guitar player, has your relationship with different sounds or different recordings change, you know, now when you listen to Keith Richards on those early records, is it weird to think he was so young playing those records?
It is. It makes me wonder what I was doing.
That's how I feel.
24. Yeah. I mean, I was definitely more concerned with the party at that point, but that's not really that true. I mean, you know, we were wild. We were all kind of sowing our oats back then, but I mean, those dudes were the giants, walked the earth then as far as rock and roll music is concerned, you know, and they created this thing that was so new, and then it's kind of like, well, where does it go from here, you know? That's why, I mean, it's so all that music is so great, that's why we all still love it, you know. I'm just thinking about the Stones in particular. I was talking to a friend the other day that was on, he was on the road with Stone Temple Pilots, and they opened a bunch of shows in 94. And he said, I watched them operate, and it's like, it's almost like the president has come to town. You know, it was just such a huge event. And he was like, these dudes invented this way of touring, this larger than life, opulent event kind of thing. You know, the Stones, that they were the first.
Do you still go back and try to figure out those little, because the Stones are like a weird band to learn, because you can learn the harmony and the structure of the song, and then you can always go back and pick out like little kind of things. Do you obsess over those little details, or to you it's like, if you have the structure, do you put the Charlie Starr stamp on it and you make it your own?
When I was younger, I did. I mean, you know, when you're learning the guitar and I think, like so many other players, you obsess with, I got to play this right. I got to play it, you know, just like he played it. And then I think as you get older, maybe your brain gets a little too crowded with information, so that's not as important, you know. But it is, I mean, there are, you know, the Stones, that kind of music is so, it's obviously so melody-based. Even some of the guitar solos, you can sing them. Like,
totally.
So, great band. So you want to play that. You don't want to, you know, you're not trying to not play like some of those solo licks and Can't You Hear Me Knocking. You got to play that, or else
you get fired
if you don't.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening and hope you're enjoying the show. Some of you may know that I run an industry newsletter called the Nashville Briefing. Really takes you to the front row of everything happening in our industry. And if you want to learn more about it, you can go to nashvillebriefing.com to subscribe. Also, if you're enjoying this show and specifically this episode, please feel free to give us a 5-star review on your podcast listening platform. Thanks so much. Now back to the show. Totally. So, okay, so let's go back for a minute. So Bob Dylan said in a New York Times article recently, he said, you know, if you don't grow up playing bluegrass guitar, you'll never be able to truly learn it. You grew up playing bluegrass guitar. Your father was a bluegrass player. how is, was, are you grateful to kind of to have had that foundation of bluegrass guitar? How has that affected your growth as a guitar player, you know, up until now?
I definitely appreciate it. You know, when I was, my dad, he never was a solo player, like he, not a lead player. He was just playing the rhythm and singing a song. But watching the way that he would play that rhythm guitar, doom, jiggy, doom, jiggy, doom, jiggy, doom, jiggy, doom, jiggy, doom, you know, that is very important in my opinion. I see guitar players now that don't come from that. And I mean, obviously they, I'm not saying it's a mandatory prerequisite, but I think it, it really, I don't know, there's something about that whole troubadour kind of thing, like a guy that can sit with his guitar, play and sing a song. You know, that's about as essential as it gets. And those guys, that's what those guys do, you know. Bluegrass in itself is so, it's complicated music, you know, it leans forward. It's not a back in the pocket music. It's very aggressive, fast, it's like speed metal. But at the same time, it's all about improv too. So it's very like jazz in that regard. So it's very, a lot going on. And then you get the vocal harmonies, which are just, I can't imagine a world without high lonesome bluegrass vocal harmony. It's, I don't want to live in that world if it, you know, so I cherish all that, the love of all that music. And to think, you know, when I was about 11 years old, you know, none of my friends, I knew how to play like the Wreck of the Old 97 and Roll in My Sweet Baby's Arms and Blue Moon in Kentucky on the guitar. And none of my friends were interested in that. They're like, no, 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 this is how you play Iron Man, which I love too. I was like, well, I want to do that. So it was kind of like, I don't like that bluegrass music. I don't know what you're talking about. You know, it was not something to be proud of. But then it never, you know, I might have shunned it for a while and been like, well, I don't want to play hillbilly music. I want to play Led Zeppelin.
So if a little kid comes to you today and says, you know, I want to learn the guitar, I've never picked up a guitar, do you recommend, would you tell that kid, get a steel string acoustic and learn how to play bluegrass first before you get an electric? Or what would you tell that kid?
I don't know if I would go that far. Like I say, I don't know if it's essential. I think it helps. I mean, that's a good place to start. But that's a good place for, you know, somebody who's going to play the guitar and sing. Specifically, I think that's really, I mean, not even bluegrass, but like traditional country music, like Hank Williams. He was a guitar player, singer, songwriter, you know. He did actually play a lead on the song My Bucket's Got a Hole in It. He played a solo, but he didn't have to, you know.
Right.
But as far as delivering a song to someone that you wrote, you know, you can't get a better start than bluegrass guitar. But at the same time, you know, my oldest son, I tried and tried to get him to love that. And I think he was just kind of like, whatever. And then when he heard Eruption, Van Halen, he's like, now you're talking.
It's weird how that song has such a visceral effect on everyone the first time. I mean, if it is what it is, and it's bombastic and it's a bull in a china shop, but I remember so clearly hearing it for the first time. Yeah. And just being like, what the hell? And it's weird because I'd heard other heavy playing at that point, but there's something about that song that just everybody connected. It's so weird what he captured on that recording.
It's so musical, you know? I remember being probably about 10 or 11 and thinking, my sister's boyfriend at the time put the cassette in his car. And it was like, oh, and he turned it up. I mean, you know, he wasn't kidding. But I remember it was very powerful. You know, I was like, what is that instrument? That can't be a guitar doing that. And so I spent the whole rest of the day obsessed with it. You know, like, what was that? That was, you know, it really like knocked a hole in me. But me and my buddies back then, you know, guitar players were like, you were either an Eddie guy or a Randy Rhoads guy. I was always an Eddie guy because he played the blues too. He never really went in for like the classical and all these different modes and scales. It was always really, really bluesy.
You've got you've got Ice Cream Man on that first record.
Yeah, which is a John Brown song. Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
Totally. So what was the first electric guitar that you ever got?
I had a Height Deluxe. It was a Mosrite copy. And my best friend and I got on our bikes and I had an acoustic guitar and really, you know, that year was like a watershed year for me and my friends. It was like, okay. And he goes, man, there's this guy, his name's Bubba. And he lives over here on so-and-so street and he's got a guitar for sale for $25. Do you think you could get $25? I said, yeah, man, I'll do my best. And I somehow scraped up $25 and we rode over I'll never forget, we went into his house and like his mom let us in. He was in his bedroom and he was playing an unfinished Flying V. I think maybe he built it, I'm not sure. But he was sitting there playing Sabbath songs and through an amp. And he was the only person I ever saw that actually had an amp, you know. And it was like, whoa, he's ripping, listen to that. So he was like, we were 11, he may have been 16, but he looked like an old man, like a grown man, you know. And he's like, how are you doing, kids? And I'm like, good, man. I was came to ask you about the guitar, you know. And he's like, well, here she is. And he had taken that Mosrite copy guitar and striped it up like Eddie Van Halen. It was black and white red. And I was like, I'll take it, please. and he's like, you got an amp? And I said, no. And he's like, here's what you do. You got a guitar cable? I said, yeah. He goes, go to your stereo. You know, everybody had a home stereo system.
Right.
This one just so happens belonged to my sister. He's like, put a blank cassette in the record side, because everybody had a dual cassette player. Put it in the record side, hit play, record, and pause at the same time. Plug this cable into the headphone jack and turn it all the way up. And so that's what I did. And it was this crazy distorted sound coming out of the home stereo speakers. And it was like, there it is. There's Paranoid. I got it. So anyway.
So did you ever take like formal lessons, or were you pretty much, your father taught you the basics and then were you pretty much self-taught from there?
He taught me the basics. And then he had a friend who was a music teacher, not just a guitar teacher, but he was a music teacher. And when he first saw that I was really not going to put his guitar down, I mean, I think it was obvious to him, this kid is attached to my guitar. He sent me to him, and he didn't really just teach me guitar. He taught me a little bit of piano, a little bit of like singing, like, and I think he was just making sure I had pitch, you know, and then a few more chords than my dad knew. He taught me some bar chords and things like that, but that was it. And I only went to, you know, see him maybe for a few months. I remember him saying, you need to just go do what, you know, figure it out. You got it, you know, meaning that you got where it starts, the embryo or the idea. But, you know, he couldn't teach me Led Zeppelin either. So I was just like,
I got you're on your own.
Yeah. But that was it basically. And at that point too, I think my dad saw me, you know, at one point he's like, he wants to play Led Zeppelin and stuff like that. So I'm like, yeah.
So how long did that $25 guitar last you before you had to get something else?
Not very long. A couple of years. I wound up with a Les Paul copy. It was a Hondo, I believe. And it was like a cherry burst copy. That belonged to a friend's grandfather, and I wound up with it somehow, some kind of trade. But then I finally got my eye on a 1978 Gibson SG. And I think I cut grass to raise the money for that. And that was my first Gibson. And that was serious business then. And I was like, oh, look at that logo, man. Gibson.
It smells good too. Well, I remember my first Gibson, you open the case and I was shocked at the way it smelled. Smells good, like a new car, kind of.
Well, it smells like grandma's car, you know.
Yeah, something like that. So, okay, so you're rising in the scene. You're playing in, you know, a couple different bands. You were playing, you know, parts of Blackberry Smoke. We were in a band that was on a major label. You know, a lot of this has been talked about, in various places. And then, how does the first Blackberry Smoke tour come together, where you're in that first band, and then were you opening up for Jackal? Was it on the first tour? How do you get to that place where you know you're nobodies, and then all of a sudden you're on the road opening up for Jackal?
Well, Jesse Dupree, he came to Brit, our drummer, and we had gone into a studio in Atlanta and recorded two songs, Sanctified Woman and Normal Town. And this is right as we had started we came out of another band, but right as we started, you know, we wanted to play shows as Blackberry Smoke. And we did, you know, I had written maybe five songs that would be, you know, the first Blackberry Smoke songs. And anyway, Jesse heard that first demo and he was like, he invited us up to his house and we went and he was sitting there and he's like, you got any more songs? I said, nope. Well, other than the five, you know. He's like, can you write some more? I said, I'll try. And so he said, I want to make a record. And it was like, what? Like a whole record? You know, and but I did. I wrote a few more. And then we picked a couple of covers, Freeborn Man and Another Chance, which was a George Satellite song. And we went into his studio and made a record. And his plan, he's like, I want to make this record and I'm bringing you on the road. And I think he knew it's like teach you how to tour.
Why do you think he picked you guys? Did he just love the musicianship and the, like, what did he see in you guys that?
No, he did tell me one time that, you know, that first song, Sanctified Woman, and that was the first song I wrote coming out of.
It's a fun song.
And thanks. He told me, he's like, that song is like, it sounds like Shortening Bread. And everybody loves Shortening Bread. So I was like, huh, okay, well, it kind of does, the melody, you know?
Right.
But he loved it, and he still does. To this day, he's my friend, you know, but he's like, that's the song. That's my favorite Blackberry Smoke song. But I think he saw something that he loved in us, you know, and he wanted to help.
So how long were you guys, how long did it take for Blackberry Smoke to, I guess, become profitable? How long were you guys in the van? You know, was it profitable from that first tour? Were you guys walking away with a little bit of money? Or how long did it take to get to the point where it's like, you were bringing on crew members, okay, we're graduating to the bus. At what point does that start to happen?
Well, it took a long time. I mean, we were rolling around in that van, you know, going all over the country with no crew. For 8 years, maybe, you know, and even after making Little Piece of Dixie, I mean, we had hired one crew guy then, but we were, you know, a 4-piece band basically with one crew guy. And then, I mean, we were putting in the hours and more and more people were starting to come see us, which was good. And you could see that very slowly, you know, building and building and building. When we made the Whippoorwill record, Zach Brown, the last, it's a long, complicated story, but the last independent label situation that we were involved in fell apart.
So, yeah.
And we were label-less. And Zach Brown had that year, you know, he had a huge year. And he was a friend in Atlanta, you know, band. And he got wind, you know, that we were kind of without a label. And so he basically came around and was like, hey, I'm starting a label. Would you guys like to be a part of it? And we were like, yeah, we had already done shows, like cruises with him. He was on some of the Skinner cruises that we were on, and we were all kind of friendly, you know. But it was pretty easy decision. Like, well, this makes perfect sense. This is almost like Capricorn. You know, he's basically going to form this new Capricorn type situation in Atlanta with us and the Wood Brothers and Levi Lowry and Sonya Lee. And, that was a great year. But he was like, well, what do you want to do? You want to come on the road with me? And we were like, yeah, but we really want to make a new record. Cause we've been wanting to make this record and we haven't been able to for 2 years, you know, while we've been tied up with all these problems. And so he's like, done, go make a record. Why don't you go do it at, Echo Mountain in Asheville? It's a great studio. We were like, okay. And we went there and that was the moment. Like, funny too, we recorded a bunch of songs that I I thought that we should have recorded them on the previous record, but some people disagreed with me, some people in the business. And that was one thing that taught me. It's like, always trust what your heart tells you and your own gut instinct, because you're always right for you, always. If your gut tells you yes, then it's yes. If your gut tells you no, it's no. It never lies to you. And so,
absolutely.
Looking back, so we go into the studio, and we basically, it was the production team. It was Blackberry Smoke, Clay Cook, Matt Mangano, and executive producer Zach Brown. But basically what he did was like, here's some money, go make a record. Go make the record you want to make. And that's what we did, and that's our best-selling record. And it's the songs that I really thought were, these are the songs for a Blackberry Smoke record at that time, you know. And
absolutely.
I was right. And it you know, the people proved that I was right. I didn't. They bought it. They bought way more of it than they had ever bought one previously. And as soon as we started playing shows, the line started getting longer and longer and longer. And that's when it was like, oh, we got to hire a crew. Well, the crew can't all fit in this van. We better get a bus. You know?
We better get a bus.
So it was right around 2009, 2010. That was the jumping off point.
So I may lose half my audience with this question, but I'm curious. Song like Pretty Little Lie, do you write that with a Bender guitar? Do you write the song and then you go, this would be great with a little B Bender part on it? How do you decide what guitars get a Bender? Because there's a couple Blackberry Smoke songs that you use a Bender on.
Yeah. No, I didn't write it with a Bender. I wrote that with Travis Meadows, who's a great writer, great friend.
Great writer in Nashville. Yeah. Yeah.
Written a lot of songs with him now. We kind of are attached at the hip. But definitely didn't have Bender in mind because we were sitting with two acoustic guitars. But we started to, we had a band rehearsal and I said, all right, I got this new one. And played it, and you know, it's just one of those things where you're like, you know what it needs? A Bender.
A Bender. Done. Yeah. Simple.
Done.
Okay, wait. So let's go back for 1 second. So you're in the van for 8 years. It's hard touring in a band, or you know, in a van with other guys. How do you keep the peace? And are you frustrated that things aren't moving faster? Like, how, like, it's almost crazy that you guys would. Now, in hindsight, it paid off, but it's crazy that you guys would grind it out for 8 years and not quit. What pushed you guys through that? Or how did you guys keep going, keep playing that game?
Well, I mean, we had sort of figured out our business model. You know, Britt, our drummer, he's...
The drummer's always the business guy.
Yeah, he loves business, and he loves merchandise, and he loves art. Because he's an artist, he's a graphic designer by trade, and you know, we had so many conversations over the years about, you know, what's so cool about you know, this Stones tour. Look at the tour shirt that came, that, you know, that was attached to this tour. You know, the whole ball of wax, you know. And so, you know, we knew from the very beginning, even from the Jackal guys, it's like, well, you know, selling your records and selling your merchandise, that's how you make a living, you know, on the road, you know. I mean, we were making nothing to play a club back then, you know. It was just like wherever we could get booked. But luckily, to answer your question, I mean, the what we were getting paid or guaranteed to play a show got a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger and a little bit. It's all about, you know, supply and demand. When people would know that, okay, well, more people are going to come next time. So it was just a really slow process, to answer your question. It took 8 years because we didn't have a hit and we didn't have any support from radio at all. If radio's always ignored us, I don't know. I mean, I'm not complaining. It's just a fact. People all the time would be like, why don't they play y'all on the radio? I'm like, I don't know. I don't have an answer for that.
But, unbelievable. So, yeah. So do you still like going out on the road? Is it still fun for you?
Love it. I love it. This just going last week. I mean, obviously we've all been at home for 5 months, but it was heavenly. It's just, it becomes part of who you are. And even playing two nights in one town can be a little bit weird because you get so used to years and years of boom, goodbye, boom, see you later, boom, see you next time, boom, you know, it just is, it's an addiction.
So I imagine, I mean, the motions of the show itself are pretty similar every day, sound check, you know, opener, go up, play, get up, whatever it is. But what else do you do when you're in each city? Are there things, do you look for the best coffee shop? Do you try to find a museum? What's the thing that you try to do?
I mean, record stores, music stores, bowling, coffee, restaurants, whatever. Hey, you know, somebody's like, hey, the Pirate Museum is across the street. I was just the other day. I'm like, hell yeah, we're going to the Pirate Museum. I mean, the only drawback, well, not the only drawback, but one downside to touring is you don't get to do as much as you would think because there's not always that much
time. There's not that much time, right?
You know, a lot of the time you're up until 4 in the morning and you're not going to want to get up at 7 to go and, well, I don't, to go and catch, you know, the early Pirate Museum, whatever.
The 7 o'clock showing of the Pirate Museum.
You know, and yeah, you have to sleep, you know, that's one thing that keeps you well out there, keeps you healthy is get as much sleep as you can. But man, I just love it all though, you know.
How do you guys keep the peace? It looks like you guys always get along really well, you know, on the outside, you know.
Yeah.
Is there like, don't talk to Paul at like, you know, 7:30, or like, how do you guys, you know, give everyone space and keep the peace?
Well, I think you just learn, you know, exactly what you said. I'm not gonna mess with him today. I see that look in his eye, you know, it's, but I think we're grown-ups now, you know, it's like, we used to fight about stupid stuff and probably still will, but I think you just get tired of all that and try to keep egos in check and just know that we're all working toward the same goal, you know?
Totally. Okay. Through Charlie Starr's eyes, who is the best guitar player in the world ever in history? In history.
Well, I guess there's a lot of criteria, a lot of boxes that have to be ticked. Because one dude might be really good at one kind of thing and one dude is really good at another kind of thing. But, man, that's tough. Best in the world. Merle Travis is way up there.
Interesting. Interesting answer. Okay.
I mean, he was such an innovator, you know. Some people tell me that are from that part of the country, from Kentucky, you know, they're like, well, he wasn't the only one doing that. There was.
Right. But he was the one that got recorded and there's video of it.
They're like, he learned that from Old Man Simpson that lived down at the, you know, but I don't know. I mean, obviously Jimi Hendrix was just, nobody had played that way before with that kind of prowess. I mean, think about when people first were hearing that first record, that was 1966, 67, like early 60s.
Yep, right.
And pretty earth-shattering kind of change from, I mean, if you even listen to like Satisfaction, and it's like, and then you hear Purple Haze. It's like, oh, whoa. Okay.
It's not even the same thing.
Yeah. But I don't know, man. Look at Wes Montgomery. Who can do that with his thumb?
Right. But Derek Trucks today, you say, that's your guy today.
I think he's the best guitar player I've ever seen up close. And it's not only because he, like the speed is ferocity a word or ferociousness?
Yeah, I'll take it. He
can get you with all that where it's just like, oh my God, that's just, but his touch, and he plays with so much emotion. I was talking to his mom. We were on the Wheels of Soul tour and we were all kind of standing around watching the show. And he does this thing where he will bring the band down to a whisper and he's barely whispering on the guitar and the entire audience hushes with him. They're hanging on everything he does, and because he's like taking them on this emotional ride, with him, you know? And I said, you know what? I don't know that I've seen a whole lot of people that can do that, what he's doing right now. I mean, they are hanging on every noise he makes, and it's all good noise.
Totally.
And he's the most humble dude in the world. He'll just, if I said that, he'd laugh, you know, and be like, oh, stop it. But he can make a grown man cry just by playing the guitar.
He is so expressive, and I've seen him a couple times. I saw him in the Allman Brothers a couple times, and I feel like I always know he's going to be amazing, and I either forget how good he is or he keeps getting better. It's one or the other, but every time I see him, I go, I don't even remember him being this good, and I remember him being amazing anyway. It's like every time I see him, it's like it's better and better. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. But there, you know, that even in saying that, I mean, there's no best, you know? I mean, everybody's different. It's like a thumbprint, fingerprint, whatever. I've seen Warren Haynes. Every time I watch him play, I'm just like, Jesus Christ, dude, what can you not do on that thing? You know, it's just a part of his being. I don't know, man. Yeah.
Are there different front men that you look at for inspiration or that you admire or that, you know, any like things you've done? You've got the Hell Yeah, of course, on the junior. Any from Ernest Tubb, any, you know, guys that you look at and admire from the front end side of things?
So many. I mean, Mick Jagger, I'm nothing like that, but he was obviously, it still is the most entertaining front man.
Oh, beyond.
Never boring. But I mean, I always loved Tom Petty. I thought, because he never said anything goofy. He always carried himself with a cool that not everybody has, you know. And Jesse from Jackal, when we used to watch, you know, them back in the early 2000s, I would watch him and be like, I told him once, I was like, you should have, if you weren't doing this, you'd be a televangelist, like one of those really extreme ones, because he's got the gift of gab. I don't have that, you know. He can just go, and it's never boring. And I'm like, where is that story coming from? It's never true. You know, he's just like riffing. And it's always, he was born to do that. Yeah.
I love it. Okay, I'll end with this. Any quarantine gear purchases, any recent guitars, amps, pedals, anything fun that's that you bought online or anywhere else?
Yeah, I bought some stuff. I bought a really good 65 Fender Deluxe Reverb. That's great.
I bought a 66 Deluxe Reverb.
Oh, did you? Okay, well then.
From Carter's, and well, so I had a Maz 18. It was actually just before the quarantine, but I had a Maz 18 that I brought in for repair, and I was talking to the guy about how I've never owned a Fender amp, and he said, we just got a great 66 and one of the best 66s I've ever heard. And I was like, yeah, sure. I sat in front of this thing and I said, okay, that's the best guitar sound I have ever had, ever, period. But I went home, I literally had a dream about it in my sleep, and then I went back and bought it.
See, that's what you tell your wife. You can't fight with a dream. That's like fate.
that's right. Wait, okay, so you just bought a 65?
Yeah, and I got it from Rumble Seat, just up the street from Carter. But it's great. And got a 58 TV Junior, which is ridiculous.
Is it yellow?
It is TV yellow.
Oh my God.
and then a couple of pedals. This Fuzz Face clone from Japan called Orga Face. It's about as close as it gets. I mean, you know, a real Fuzz Face is probably $2,000 now. So I remember when those used to be like holding doors open in your buddy's jam room. It's like, what's that? Oh, that's an old fuzz pedal. Nobody cares about that. Oh boy.
Oh man. Okay. That's about it. I mean, I love my, there's some, it's weird because I think the volume knob on mine has definitely been just, you know, it was definitely the most used knob because it turns so much smoother than every other knob on the amp. And yeah, it is so sensitive to it. It's the, even to my touch, but also to the volume knob, that tiny, and I'll be like, oh, this is way too loud. And the tiniest little thing between like 3 and a tiny bit under 3 is like, all the difference. It's insane how those things were made.
Oh, so good. I took it to the studio making the record with Cobb, and I used it most of the time. Like, we would plug in things and he's like, it ain't beating that today. No, just right. One thing.
I'm sometimes missing a little bit of the low end. Like, I sometimes wish the low end was a little fatter, because mine sounds a little bit tubby on the low end almost.
Really? Huh. What speaker's in it?
I gotta double check. It's not the original speaker, but it's something old. I gotta double check exactly what's in it. But whenever I'm playing power chords or whatever, it's not the most satisfying, but it works. But the high end is just insane. Like, anything like mid to like high end, anything not on the E and A string is just like, it hits me so hard. It makes me smile when I play it. It's incredible.
Yeah. That's what counts.
That's what counts. How many juniors do you have? Is that your favorite guitar all around to get?
I think so. I don't know. I really love them. They, for whatever reason, they sound like I want a guitar to sound more than any other guitar. I probably have 8 or 9.
I'm dying for a junior. I think it might be my next purchase. I was actually talking to someone about this, and I don't have a Les Paul or anything like it, and I think a junior would be so fun, because they're minimal, they're easy, they're lightweight.
Yeah.
Then I'm Keith Richards.
Yeah. Gosh, then they're a good sound investment too, because they're right now. I mean, they're way more expensive than I ever dreamed they would be. And they just keep going up. So
I was just talking to my friend about how the junior is like the secret vintage guitar investment, because you can actually kind of afford them and they're badass.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they've doubled in value in 3 years. It's insane.
It's crazy. Unbelievable. Yeah. Well, Charlie, I won't keep you. Thank you so much for taking the time. This was so fun. I've been a fan of the band since I was in high school. When I was in college, I was working at the House of Blues in Boston. And you guys came through, and I remember pushing those cases and rolling out those rugs and thinking, this is the most badass night ever. I think the couple days later, Joe Perry was playing, and I was pushing cases that said Aerosmith, and I was like, this is the greatest job in the world.
Yeah, man.
But awesome talking with you, and I can't wait to hear the new record, and can't wait to see what you guys continue to do in the future, because it's never boring with Blackberry Smoke. It's always fun and exciting.
Thanks so much. Great talking to you.
Absolutely. Talk to you soon. Bye.
All right.
Charlie Starr, the frontman, singer, guitar player of Blackberry Smoke. There you have it. Thanks so much for listening. And thanks again to Charlie for taking the time to come on the episode. It was such a thrill. I'm so glad we were able to make it happen. Tomorrow night, depending on when you are listening to this episode, if you're listening today on Tuesday, tomorrow night, the 23rd, Blackberry Smoke is playing live at the Ryman. Tickets are still on sale at blackberrysmoke.com. Check them out and check out their tour schedule, because they're actually touring right now, doing a series of drive-in concerts. Check it out. Look into it. Be there. Show up. It's going to be amazing, I promise. I'm actually hoping to get to one of the shows myself, and I can't wait to do so. The Zach Kuhn Show is mixed by Sam Heyman, and our theme music is by Justin Johnson. And if you want more content from us, and you're like, this was so great, I can't get enough, you can subscribe to our newsletter at nashvillebriefing.com, and you can follow us on socials, everything at Nashville Briefing. Thanks again for tuning in, and we will see you next week. Bye.